How do the metaphors that we use to describe ourselves and our experiences shape how we see the world and how we see ourselves? We discuss this and more with special guest Dr. Joy Clarkson on this episode of The Overthinkers. Hello, thinking people, Welcome to The Overthinkers, a home for people who love to have fun thinking deeply. I'm your host, Joseph Holmes, filmmaker, film critic, emperor of analogies, and with me, as always, is my threateningly thoughtful co-host.
Nathan Clarkson, actor, author, filmmaker, and proud emotional robot. You'll get that.
Okay. already making our guest angry. With us today is a very special guest. She is an author, podcast host, a research associate in theology and literature at King's College London, and books and culture editor for Plough Quarterly with a PhD in theology from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. She is the host of the podcast Speaking with Joy, is the author and co-author of multiple books, including Girls Club and Aggressively Happy, as well as writing for outlets like Christianity Today, The Tablet, and Plough. Her latest book, You Are a Tree, is in stores now. She is the generous, the gentle, the genius, Dr. Joy Clarkson. Joy, welcome back to the show.
It is always a pleasure to be with you all.
It's fine to have you. Like, you know, it's fine. We had a few guests cancel, and you know, it is what it is. So you got to call the little sister. Joseph, you didn't mention the most important thing about her. We are related.
I am so sorry.
Yes, that's how we're able to score such a highbrow guest.
Nathan and I are related and not married, because people always think I'm married to Joel.
Yeah, there's too many Clarkson siblings doing too many things around. And then I have a wife with the last name Clarkson. So no one knows how we're all related. They just see Clarkson pop up everywhere, which is really
Some of them are siblings. Some of them married. Who's to say?
Yeah, you got to figure it out. It's like a whole drama.
I do have a fantasy that will never happen, that at one point there will be an episode that is just all of the Clarksons on the same episode, and then just no, I will never get a word in edgewise.
Well, that will be when we decide to end our public career.
There you go.
In one fell swoop.
Anyway, it's really great to have you on, Joy. Today, very excited, we're going to be discussing how our metaphors shape us. But first, Nathan, if people enjoy our discussions and want to engage with more of our content and meet fellow overthinkers like themselves, where can they go?
They can go to theoverthinkersjournal.world, where they can find out more about their hosts, and it's there they can send us all of their love and hate mail. They can also go to our online private Facebook group called The Overthinkers, where we have almost 20,000 other overthinkers just like yourself talking about all the fun stuff and getting to discussions that we talk about here, and we're posting as well lots of very intellectual but also very silly memes. So we want you among our ranks. If you do enjoy the podcast, please consider you are a tree.
Plant the thought.
Hey!
Leaving a review and sharing with a friend. All right, that's it for me.
Intellectual and silly, I think this pretty much sums this up. And I hope hopefully we will get to represent both of those things, but we may be just having too much fun. Everyone ready to get started?
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Great. Humans have always used metaphors to describe themselves and their human experiences. The lovers in the biblical Song of Songs describe each other as lilies and doves. Plato described the human mind as a chariot, where the horses are the passions, and the human mind is that what must steer them. In our modern day, many of our metaphors are built around machines. We can say that we need to recharge or process. But while we choose our metaphors to describe ourselves, many argue that these metaphors can also change how we see ourselves, not always to our benefit. In Nancy Percy's new book on masculinity, she points out that after Darwin's theory of evolution became widely known, metaphors around men as violent, competitive beasts and animals became more popular, which increasingly encouraged that same behavior. If so, many are asking, how are our machine-focused metaphors shaping how we see ourselves? Dr. Joy, I love saying Dr. Joy, how do you see the metaphors we've embraced as a culture more widely shaping us? And how can we choose better, or at least add better metaphors to them?
That's an excellent question, Joseph, which I hope my book answers a little bit, although it's also a very big topic. So there's a lot of things you could say about that.
Terrible.
I think the first thing I'm going to do is not answer your question, give a little ramble about metaphors. You did a great job of talking about kind of the fact that we always reach for metaphors. That's been something that we've always done as human beings. And there's lots of research that suggests, like from neuroscientists, that language itself tends to be metaphorical. We have this idea that you can kind of like not, that you can speak literally. But words are always describing something that is in the world with this kind of, it's always kind of an abstraction out of things. So the book Metaphors We Live By talks about how even when we try to kind of get away from metaphorical language, we use all these metaphors that mean to. We talk about things, we talk about feeling up or down, and that's kind of like metaphors we use for being emotionally happy or being depressed. And even just that language of up or down mirrors kind of our bodies and those things. And so there's this idea that metaphors are basically, it's us drawing from things in the material world to describe things that maybe aren't material. So whether that's emotions, which are kind of, you know, we feel them in our bodies, but they don't have, you can't bottle an emotion up and put it somewhere. So it's a very natural human thing to reach for visible ways to describe kind of invisible feelings. And I think the reason that we reach so often for machines is that now we're just surrounded by machines all the time, right? So all three of us are talking to each other through various machines. I see you have machines on your ears. If you can describe the machine, we're talking through our computers. We have microphones. And so, of course, when we are kind of grabbing for something in the world to describe our experiences, we use machines. But the problem is that I think there are better and worse metaphors. There are things that are closer and further away from the experiences that we're trying to describe. And one of the things that Lakoff and Johnson talk about too is that, like you said, the metaphors we use kind of shape our expectations of a thing, right? So if I talk about myself as a machine, if I say I recharge and I'm going to update my friend and I am processing something, then I'm kind of unconsciously describing myself like a computer. And if I'm describing myself as a computer, then I'm expecting myself on some level to behave like a computer. I'm taking the nature of a computer to myself. And what's true about computers? They do the same thing every day. They're oriented around productivity. They have bunches of replaceable parts, and they're reasonably kind of self-sufficient, right? Computers don't need to like spend time together to continue, unless you need to like airdrop something, I guess. And so if I kind of have that unconscious expectation of myself, then when I recharge for a weekend and I'm still exhausted because maybe I'm burnt out or there's something emotionally that I haven't dealt with, I'll feel really frustrated with myself because I'll feel like, well, I haven't, I should be, I've recharged, I should be better now. Or if I think that I've emotionally processed something, quote unquote, and then 2 months from now I feel angry or sad again, I'll go, what's wrong with me? I'm a computer. I should be able, you know, we don't consciously think I'm a computer, but the way we've been talking about ourselves makes us think that that's how we should behave. And so that metaphor can produce a lot of guilt. It can also kind of begin to ingrain us with the idea that our value as a human being is for what we produce, right? Because computers don't exist for their own sake, right? We don't just go, wow, the computers, they don't need to process anything. They don't need to connect to the internet. They're just beautiful. And so if a computer breaks, we just get rid of it. It's like, it's not a huge emotional thing. Maybe you wrote your first novel on your computer, that's emotional, but the computer itself is not valuable. It's valuable for an end. And if you kind of begin to incorporate that assumption about yourself because of the metaphors you use, then when you're not productive, when you're not fulfilling your purpose or function, or you're not seeing output, you can start to feel like, what, I'm not worth anything because I'm not producing anything. And I say that very generally, but I've definitely felt that, right? When there's times when I'm very unproductive, or where I'm, you know, quote unquote functioning slowly, I start to think I'm not valuable. And that can be because we have this kind of overarching metaphor for human life that imagines us to be kind of robotic, to be able to produce things, to be able to have the same expectations every day. And I see that causing a lot of exhaustion. One of the other, I don't talk about this that much in the book, but one of the other kind of overarching metaphors I think we reach for is money, because there's also money everywhere we look in the world. So we talk about investing in relationships and in marriages. You talk about who's doing the second shift, right? As though your whole like relationship with another human being is a corporate structure that could be broken up into something that's, you know, measurable. And I think that has all kinds of problems too, because it imagines that the kind of unmeasurable gift of human relationships is something that can be counted up and, you know, measured by numbers. And that's such a, in my mind, corrosive way to think about relationships, because I think that if you're always thinking of it as sunk cost, things like that, then how are you going to have the kind of thing that builds love, that builds families and communities and relationships? So that's a very long, meandering way to say that this is how I think it affects our lives. And that's why we do it. We're surrounded by money. We're surrounded by machines. So of course we use it. And my thought is, well, if those things are not proving to be effective or fruitful or good for us, then we have to look for other metaphors that are better, that are more appropriate to the human experience, that are more appropriate for what it's like to be a human. And so in the book, what I did was I said, well, what are the metaphors that have lasted the test of time? And so I looked at a bunch of them. So like for humans, trees are one of the kind of like both in scripture, but also just in general, we intuitively talk about people being rootless or fruitful or, you know, blooming late. Those are all tree plant related. That's one of the ways we just intuitively speak about human beings. So that's what I think. I forgot what your question actually was now, but I think that should give us something to talk about.
But this is absolutely great.
It's really, I mean, for somebody who forgot what the question was, you did a pretty decent job of answering it.
Great.
I absolutely love this concept. I remember you were talking about it a few years ago. And it's one of those concepts, and it really turned into a book, that, you know, when you see like something that's written or a movie or a book, and it's like, why didn't I write that? This is definitely one of those, such a great concept. And I think it's a really important one that you were writing about. And it's also one that we don't know is important, but really, really is, right? So you can look at all of the neuroscience and the psychology. Humans understand things through lenses. And so we've talked often about how humans have a narrative understanding of reality. And as well, psychologists found they have a metaphoric understanding of reality. In fact, intelligence is often based off of, you can understand the metaphor, something behind metaphors, you can understand the abstract idea of a metaphor. And so there's something intrinsic in us that essentially that is kind of implanted. I'm trying to use a metaphor that's not, I was going to say programmed, but I went with implanted, so be very proud of me. Good. There's something in us that is made to respond and understand reality through the picture of metaphor. Right. And we don't often think about the metaphors we use for ourselves, for other people, for our lives, for whatever it might be. But you were right. They do have an effect on how we see ourselves and how we value ourselves. Now, I'm actually going to talk. I'm going to give a couple reasons why I like, and I want you to respond to them in a minute, why I like technological metaphors and what they do for me that's good. And then I'm going to give you what you, and then I'm going to, you already said it, but I'm going to agree with you on why I think they're detrimental. Particularly if that's all we're using. I never even thought about the money metaphors. What a great way to think of that. Investing in a relationship, like my wife is, you know, some sort of stock that I bought and I hope it pays off. which is really funny to think about.
It's also like intuitive, because when you're talking about money, you're talking about value, and your relationship is something you value. But yes, there's a limitation to the metaphor, and you have to keep that in view.
Yes. So absolutely. One of the reasons I think people gravitate towards technological, as opposed, you know, in addition to it is all around us all the time, as you pointed out. But I think there's something that in the technological metaphors that we say about ourselves, and this could be gendered, this could be different kinds of people, but there's behind every technology, there's a purpose, right? So a computer has a purpose. And if I know one thing about humans, one of the most deep-seated desires that we have is to feel purposeful. So that's why I think one of the reasons that I think people oftentimes feel drawn towards technological metaphors is because we desire to be here to, one, have been designed for a purpose. Because we're constantly facing this nihilistic kind of ideas crop up in culture, where we have to face this idea that we're not here for any particular reason. Everything is chaos, whatever it might be. So if we can conceptualize ourselves as a machine, Then we can say, well, at least I was meant to do something and I should do something. We have those shoulds and oughts that can give us a little bit of definition into the importance of our story. Now, what you brought up is, I think, a really, really beneficial thing to realize as we're doing this. So yes, I think purpose is a really inherent thing to the human mind and soul. And I think that the machine metaphor can do that, but it only goes so far. And when, if you conceptualize yourself as a machine, what ends up happening, you already brought it up, so you beat me to it, but it's, you are disposable. Because I was talking about this with TV, about your book, and it's like, you know, what do we do? Because our TV has a broken pixel in it. And it's like, if it gets a few more broken pixels, what am I going to do with it? I've enjoyed the TV. It's served a purpose for me. But if it gets a little more broken, I'm going to toss it. It's disposable. So the more we practice seeing ourselves as machines, yes, with a purpose, but it only goes so far, to the point where the more we conceptualize, so with those metaphors, we're going to start to see ourselves as disposable. And I think that's a really, really huge thing right now in society, is we're trying to gauge the value of humanity. And I think the more we consider ourselves through this lens of mechanics, we're going to see ourselves as things that can be replaced and things that can be done away with and disposed of. And I think that's a really unhealthy thing for the psyche. And I'm so glad to kind of explore this in your book.
What is my purpose?
You pass butter.
Oh my God.
Yeah, welcome to the club, pal.
But, you know, so it's interesting. You bring up a lot of these different metaphors and ideas, and we know that we're intrinsically metaphorically minded. So I'm curious to get, I'm gonna let Joseph jump in here, but I'm really excited to hear more about what you think good metaphors we can understand ourselves that are as adequate as the ones we've been using. Because I think we do need adequate metaphors to describe our, and to feel purposeful and to understand relationships. But I think you're right in that these are not adequate, at least as far as human worth and value. Oh, there we go. So I'm curious to talk more and hear more about what you think are more adequate metaphors we can begin to describe our experiences, our relationships, and ourselves. But Joseph, I want to hear your thoughts on this real quick, and we'll throw it back to Joy.
Yeah, sure. So just as a supplement to some of this stuff you guys have been talking about, I mean, talking about the literalness and metaphoricalness of language. We have another podcast where we actually talk about this with a biblical scholar, Dr. Drew Johnson, where we talk about, should we read the Bible literally? Or we have an extended discussion about how, you know, the discussion about, like, well, what do you mean by reading the Bible literally when so much of language is itself metaphorical? You know, I mean, again, if you want to have a challenge, try to, you know, talk an entire day or even just, like, you know, for 30 minutes without, and describe your experience without using metaphorical language, if you can even do that. Because as you all said, all of our language is, to a degree, an abstraction of something physical that we are attempting to describe. And just the whole idea that human beings can do that is really interesting. And it is, to a certain degree, what's also interesting to me is the necessity to narrow how we see something. Because, you know, somebody just talked about, like, if you were to write every, or to draw every detail in this room, you would never finish, because there's just too many details in the room. Just, you know, the chipping on the wall or whatever. And so we really do have to pick the lines that we do, the words we use to describe things. We're always, to a certain degree, leaving stuff out when we are describing ourselves and describing each other, describing our experiences. What we choose to leave out is just as much. But what it does it reflect our values. It's like, what is actually important about us to describe? So again, our metaphors break down eventually. They always do. But the ones we choose actually describes what we're valuing. So again, if we are using technological metaphors, you know, if we are about productivity and such, we are saying that one of the things we value about ourselves is our ability to be productive, is our ability to, you know, such and such. What I think is interesting, again, I also have, you know, sort of similar things to Nathan, where it's like, I do like a lot of the technological metaphors because they do reflect the sort of analytical aspects of my experience. You know, when I say, like, you know, if I am going to say, you know, describe myself as a tree, you know, there aren't a lot of analytical kind of, like, oh, I'm piecing together, you know, bits of information in order to combine those in an intentional way. There's not a lot of those metaphors that resonate deeply when you're talking about trees. Also, you know, with recharging, one of the benefits of something like recharging is I can choose when to sit down and take a break and recharge myself purposefully, sort of like Nathan says, which I can also do with my, you know, phone. I can't, a tree doesn't do the same thing where it chooses when it's going to, you know, sit down and do something, be productive versus not. So there's a lot of aspects of that that I think, however, I think two things. One is, one of the things that's really beneficial about your book is it does ask us to actually interrogate the metaphors that we're using. So, you know, if you do think that perhaps a piece of technology is the right metaphor for your particular experience, at least kind of justify why that's a better metaphor than something else and recognize that it's not a complete version of what you're doing and see if there is like a better metaphor that you can use that does also express the experience. So I guess, you know, one of the things, so I would, off of Nathan, I would be interested in hearing you say is for something that is, you know, describing the sort of the thinking analytical sides of human experience, are there ones that actually are better that not machine related, you know? But then also, when does a person know that their metaphors they're using are out of balance and doing more kind of harm than good? So those would be something I'd be interested in kind of hearing you talk about.
So I feel like this makes me want to bring up one of the things I talk about, and actually that has to do with the way I title all the chapters. So I almost called the book "You Are Not a Tree" with "not" being in parentheses. My publisher thought that was too confusing. But the reason that I wanted to do that was because the nature of all metaphors is that you are not, in fact, actually a tree in the same way that you're not actually a machine, right? The word metaphor comes from a Greek word that means to carry over. So Aristotle, you know, famously defines it as carrying over the properties that belong to one thing to another thing. So when I talk about myself recharging and processing and updating, I'm taking things that properly belong to a machine and I'm applying it to me. But we all know that, or we should know that the function of a metaphor is that I'm not a machine, I'm not a tree. And that if you have that consciously in mind, that I am a machine, but I'm also not one, it actually makes you pay closer attention to what you're trying to describe because you're aware of how far the metaphor can go, but not further. So I'm not against the machine metaphor because I think it does. There are lots of ways that talking about that a machine helps me understand aspects of my experience. But I think the important thing is to keep that kind of brackets, you know, parenthetical "not" in view. And I think that when we do that, it makes us be more careful with our words and more careful with our expectations and to pay closer attention to the things in our lives and experiences that we're trying to understand. And so in a way, that doesn't actually answer your question about the more cerebral or methodical kind of ways of thinking, but it shows that sense that it's not just about poetry and art, it's about using kind of the words that we use to describe things to be more and more precise and more pay closer and closer attention to the things that it is that we're describing. Also, I was thinking, just on a side note, with the machine thing, I think that a part of the reason that machines are also appealing as a way of describing things is that machines are designed, right? We have a sense that someone designed a machine, that they're intricate, that there's a kind of sophistication to them. And so there's a way in which that is like we want to think that we're designed, that we have kind of a purpose that we're created for. The thing that I think is interesting, and this is just like a nerdy aside, but it was something I was thinking about this week, is that I think
those are our favorite kind of asides.
So I think in the past, like if you talk to a medieval person, they would think that a tree was intrinsically meaningful and a tree had a specific purpose more than a machine, because they would say, well, a tree within itself, a seed, you know, within itself will naturally unfold into a tree, will naturally bear fruit. Like that is that's intrinsic potential to a tree. Whereas a piece of metal will not intrinsically become a machine. So they would understand a tree as being intrinsically meaningful, intrinsically having a purpose that just naturally unfolds in the same way that human beings kind of have this intrinsic, you know, purpose or design to be in relationship with others and to worship God. Whereas they would see a machine as being, as has an extrinsic purpose, right? That it is something that becomes purposeful because humans go, well, I'm going to make this and use it for this reason. So that, I think, is a reflection of the fact that we now relate to nature as not having an intrinsic purpose, and we relate to nature as not being a thing which is created by God to communicate to us. And so I think that's just something interesting, which then means that we, again, the metaphor goes back, then we don't pay attention to nature as something which might communicate about our experience, as something that God might have invested with intrinsic meaning. So that's just a thought. And it's interesting too, because that shift kind of from medieval to modern, the big way that people talk about nature in the scientific revolution is as a machine, because they're seeing it as this intricate, sophisticated, designed thing. And by doing that, they weren't trying to like say it didn't have meaning. They were trying to say like, wow, look at creation. It's like this giant machine that God made, and it's beautiful and it has intricate purpose. But that was just something I was thinking about when you were saying that, Nathan, was that now for us, a machine seems to have more intrinsic purpose. But if you looked back in the old days, they would think, well, a machine might or might not have purpose, whereas a tree has that kind of that sense that it will unfold into a tree no matter what happens. And anyway, that was just a thought. That was a nerdy thought.
That was fantastic. And, you know, these are great thoughts about how, because I love having this discussion around, like Joseph said, investigating, or whatever the word you used was, investigating how we describe ourselves and what those words and ideas are doing to our self-perception and our perception of God. You know, and in thinking about the juxtaposition between the technological and the natural, those different things. Yeah, I think, Joy, I didn't bring up a great point. I think one of the draws to the technological isn't just the, you know, the output that we can bring, but also it's designed, right? So it feels that we're intended. There's a mind behind our existence. But the interesting thing, and we talked a little bit about this, but just to dig a little further about maybe investigating that and other kind of metaphors in that arena, that technological metaphoric arena, would be, you know, and we mentioned this a little bit, a machine is only valuable insofar as it is producing or working.
As an extrinsic value.
Yes. And the thing is, I you know, it's funny because I play video games, I play online, and there's a thing we say, you know, like if someone's really doing well and you can get the other bad guys, be like, oh, he's a machine, man. Like that's, if you were to talk about like literal, just like the closest you can get to this, we literally call you are now a machine. You have ceased to be human and you are something inhuman that you're doing it so precisely. And that feels good, right? So, but the caveat I would add is maybe you are a machine sometimes, and that feels super good. You know, precisely doing your output thing, killing the bad guys on the video game, whatever it might be. But the harsh reality, not the harsh reality, the reality is you're not always going to be able to do that. Machines are thrown out when they fail, when they stop working. Human nature is not. And so it's interesting to start thinking about nature has an intrinsic, or should, an intrinsic value simply for existing, right? And so this gets to a little more the theological element of, if you believe in God, if you believe in a designer, then there is actually an image of God in you that makes you intrinsically valuable. And so this is why I tend towards thinking, yeah, you know what? Try to be a machine sometimes. That's great. And it's cool if you do that output and you kill all the bad guys. But at the end of the day, you are inherently valuable, and you're not always going to be able to accomplish these things. I look at myself. I am, there are some times when I'm like, I'm super productive, and I get things out, and I kill all the bad guys in my video game, and I get a lot of writing done, and I book a thing, and I feel like a machine, and I'm doing it, but it's only a matter of time until that will end. And my output, I will exhaust. My output will slow down, or I'll just have a really bad, overwhelming, depressive day or mental illness episode. And all of a sudden, that kind of image of myself vanishes. And if I've tied myself too closely to that, I can think I'm no longer valuable as a human. So, but those are the moments in which I start to say, wait, am I intrinsically valuable, even though I'm not, doing these things for the people around me, even though I'm not accomplishing something. And the answer is yes, you are intrinsically valuable in those moments. Mm. And that's why seeing yourself in that more tree-like yeah. metaphor sense can be really healthy, because it reminds you of your inherent value. Yes, it's good to have a purpose and go and get it, but you're human, you're not as consistent. And the expectation of that will lead to some negative self-image. There's something else I was going to say.
I have thoughts on that.
Yes. Go for it.
The other thing. So then if we go, okay, well, what's another metaphor I could use for myself in that situation to kind of stop the negative self-talk? Is so if you go, okay, well, maybe I'm more like a tree. Trees also have periods of like outrageous productivity, right? Like if you see an apple tree in the fall, it will just like, it's amazing. They're literally like exploding with apples and dropping on the ground. But trees are not that way all the time. And if they were that way all the time, they would, they can sometimes hurt themselves. So like you'd be surprised how many times people have actually asked me on interviews for this book, what tree they thought I was. And I always say an apple tree, because I think apples are like, they're like humbly kind of pretty, but they also are pretty productive and they're kind of practical. But if an apple tree bears too much fruit one year, it will not bear fruit for another 2 years. And I think that's interesting, right? Because wow. human beings, sometimes if you push yourself too hard, you will crash and not be able to, you'll burn out and you'll do things. And I think that's kind of sitting with that, thinking, well, maybe, okay, let's shift the metaphorical thought. Maybe for me, being productive, trees also produce. They literally, you eat produce from a tree. Mm. But the way that a tree is productive is so different, right? It takes, they have to be rooted in a place where their roots are nourished. So if I want to think about what it looks like to be productive, then I need to think about what am I rooted in? What's nourishing me? What do I need to be fruitful? Trees take many years to grow. So if you want to be productive, you want to be amazing at something, you want to be great at a career, and you're a machine, you'll be like, I'm working so hard. Why is it not happening now? Whereas if you think of yourself as a tree, you'll go, you know what? It takes years to reach the point where a tree can bear fruit. Apple trees don't bear fruit.
I have one too. A tree needs something different in every season, which is cyclical, which yes. is unique, and it happens consistently. But there is different seasons of a tree, and every one of those seasons, something different will be happening. It's not a machine is the same all the time, or should yes. be.
And I feel more like a tree. I don't know about you, but there are, I go through seasons daily and monthly. And you know what I mean? Like there's this sense that you're not the same every single day, and that actually the down days might actually play some role in what makes you able to bear fruit on another time. The other cool thing about trees is they actually value each other intrinsically. Sorry, this is just a nerdy thing I learned about trees. So in a forest, if a tree gets like chopped down, the other trees, the way that trees get nutrients to the ground is they send mycelium, which is like this little, it's like fungus, like little mushrooms, and that allows them to pull the nutrients from the earth, like the dirt. But if one tree is chopped down, the other trees will continue to send nourishment to the tree. So if you cut open the tree, it will still be green, which it shouldn't be green because it doesn't have leaves, so it can't photosynthesize. But they do that because there's this sense that for some reason that we don't quite understand, forests keep each other alive because it's better for the forest if all of the trees are nourished, even if they're not particularly productive trees. And I think that's also such a beautiful image of what we should be for each other, that if you are struggling, we shouldn't be like, well, that one's out, like, let's take them up by the roots. You that there's this sense that even if we can't quite rationally understand it, every tree belongs in the forest, and you send nourishment to your friends when they're not productive, and that we're dependent on each other.
To Joseph, but I do want to point out that something really cool that you've done with all your nerdiness about trees, because you're a tree expert now, is you haven't let these be abstract, ethereal, you're just a cool little plant. You've actually brought logistic definition to how trees actually work. And I think this will appeal to people. So get the benefit actually of the machine analogies, because you actually showed us some of the science of actual definitive ways that trees work in nature that can give us an understanding. So, you know, Joseph, you were talking earlier about kind of the analytical side. Apparently, through the science that we can understand, there is an analytical side to understanding ourselves as nature. It's both emotional and mental. So I'm curious to hear your reflections. And then at the very last, we're going to join and tell us what tree she is. But I've been thinking about what tree I am. And Joseph, I want you to tell us what tree you are before blesses and curses.
I've also been thinking about what tree you are, Nathan, so I can't wait to hear.
Okay, good. Joseph, thoughts on everything?
I have no idea what tree I am. I'm going to be very bad at this.
I'll help you.
All right, good. Yeah, you can tell me what tree I am. That'll go better. Anyway, I think that's really cool. I mean, that aspect, and again, that is a very concrete metaphor about how a tree is a reflection of how human beings really work and need to work. We do need to pour into each other regardless of whether we're being productive. We do need to value each other intrinsically. You know, we talk about, I've talked about the show a lot about child psychology, of how children need two things in order to grow up and to be psychologically healthy. I mean, more than two things, but like two of the things is
only
need
two, everybody.
Exactly. It's just two. Yeah. No, but it is, you know, they need to be able to be held, like, you know, and love, basically, they need to be loved, you know, just as they are, and they need to be helped to grow. To be challenged to grow. And I think that you know, that fact that humans need that, and you can see that so concretely with trees, is really incredible. Now, again, there are times and there are ways in which, you know, I can, you know, choose to be productive and not just produce things naturally in ways that trees don't or can't. They kind of just do it naturally, seemingly
without
sort of trying.
Maybe they do choose. You don't know, Joseph.
At least we don't observe it in a way that makes it useful for a metaphor. But one of the things I want to actually turn back to as a larger thing we've been talking about is one of the slides of how we talk about nature itself. Because it used to be, when we talked about nature, we used the metaphor of creation more. We talked about creation, which gave it part of that purposeful, meaningful power. Now when we talk about nature, we don't describe it as much as creation. We talk it about as something that just sort of happened naturally and randomly without having a sort of purpose. And that does affect how you said, how we look at nature. So now we don't look at it and see something that is purposeful that can express love or wonder. We look at it as raw material to be used. In a similar way, the slide to talking about human beings as animals has described it. And again, you can say, well, sure, partly our metaphorical sense, but it has, coincided with talking about us as not really having the capacity for self-control or self-denial. And we talk about nature as something that, so that I think is really interesting. We look at how our metaphors have changed as a society, that we look at nature and look at ourselves. And that's something to now examine. Maybe we should start talking about nature as more as something that's analogous to creation, as something that actually has purpose and design behind it that we can actually find that purpose in. So, yes. But now, Joy, would you send us off and give us our final kind of final words, and then we'll start talking about ourselves as trees, I guess.
I know what tree you are, Joseph. I've got it. And I know what tree I am. But I want to hear what tree Joy thinks I am. But yes, wrap us up.
I will. Okay, well, I think I will just say this final thing, which is that I say this in like one of the opening bits of the book, but one of the main things I hope people will do when they come away from this book is that they will pay attention to their everyday experiences of the world. Because I think that if all my I can call them silly or profound, you know, metaphors that come from what it is to flourish as a person by looking at a tree came because I got weirdly obsessed with trees. Like, I started thinking about them. I started reading about them. I started paying attention to them. And the more I did, the more it kind of gave itself to me as a gift to think about what it is to be a human being. And when I wrote each one of the chapters, I would kind of spend a time just thinking about the thing that the metaphor was based on. So I was thinking one of the most cerebral chapters that you would enjoy, Joseph, is the one on wisdom or knowledge as light, which this one's crazy. When I realized this, I was like, oh my gosh, we use it all the time. We talk about if we say a book is good, we say that was illuminating, right? It's light. We talk about someone being bright, like if someone's smart, we say, oh, she's really bright. If we talk about someone being stupid, we say they're a bit dim.
I'm going to bring up color metaphors, like I'm feeling blue today, or she's green and envy. That's so interesting.
Yeah, or she's red hot, you know, if there's like anger. Yeah. All those things come from the world. But yeah, but light or even lucid. If we see someone's lucid, which means that, you know, they can think, that's a word that means light. So it's just absolutely everywhere you look. But what's interesting is that when you look at some of the most ancient kind of theories of mind, so what we'd think of as philosophy of the mind, they use the language of light and they talk about illuminationism. And the reason I bring that up is that I think that the more you pay attention to the world, to the experience of the sun coming up in the morning, to how your little patch of garden grows, to what it feels like to carry something heavy, when you really kind of pay attention to every little bit of your life, you will be amazed how much meaning there is and in the world outside of you to help you understand inside of you. Yeah. And so that's something that I want people to come away with, is the sense that if they pay attention to the world, they will discover that it's actually richly meaningful and helps them think more clearly about themselves, but will also reveal kind of surprising wonders and surprising insights. So that's one of the things I want people to take away from it. So I want them to just go around thinking about how wonderful it is to be alive and to notice things like light and weight and height, and that all of these kind of very basic experiences can illuminate our understanding of ourselves and of others and of God.
I love that. And
awesome.
The last thing I'd say to listeners is, go get Joy's book and investigate your metaphors. And if your metaphors are not articulating your intrinsic value, they are incomplete. And Joy will walk you through this in her book. So please go pick up your art tree. You will love it. But now the moment everyone's been waiting for, I guess it's a new segment before Blesses and Curses, which is, what tree are you? So Joseph, I know what tree you are if you haven't thought of one.
I don't know. I don't know a lot of tree names, which is part of my...
I bet you know more than you think.
So, Joseph, in my humble opinion, and I'll let Joy, the tree expert, weigh in, you're a walnut tree. Walnut trees, they produce tons of very healthy... little nuts that look like brains, and they're actually good for your brain. And so you are full of wisdom that you consistently pour out into the world. So you are a walnut tree.
Well, that was complimentary, so I'll take it.
Yeah. I thought about saying you're a scrub oak just to be mean, but we'll go with walnut tree.
And as discussed, I think I'm an apple tree. Because apple trees are like, they have their moment of kind of like aesthetic with all their flowers, but they're like quite practical and productive, but they're also like a little bit finicky. And so like, if you don't take care of them, they will like shrivel up and die or stop producing fruit. And I feel that I am also a little bit finicky. And if you don't take care of me, I will hunger strike and not produce apples.
I 100% agree. You are 1000% an apple tree. That works for you. Yep.
So
I
what
love
do you think
just
you
your
are,
ability
Nathan?
I love your ability to actually just to describe that in such vivid detail. That's great.
Well, that's what, you know, that's what apple trees do. Okay. Yes. So I am, Joy, you can tell me what you think. You're the pro. I believe I am a giant sequoia, which is also commonly known as a redwood tree, mostly because I'm a very large person and I take up a lot of space. I do have a reddish tint to my hair, and the redwoods are red. And aside from that, mostly what it gets to is people come from around the world to gaze at my beauty. So that's really why I'm a redwood sequoia, a giant sequoia.
We did not need to give Nathan a platform to do this.
Okay, I was trying to remember, are sequoias deciduous or do they have needles?
I don't know what that means.
Okay, well, I was going to say that actually, so I just did a little quick Google to make sure that I was thinking it was. That's actually very close to what I was describing you. I in my mind was not making you a sequoia. I was making you like a, I'm forgetting the name of it now. Oh, it's going to drive me crazy. It's like a smaller version of a sequoia that are in the Rocky Mountains. And part of the reason I was doing that was because A, I was like identifying you with Rocky Mountains.
Yes.
But B, I was thinking big evergreen, because they are, they're evergreens, I think.
I believe they are. And they're a little prickly in the outside, but still beautiful.
Yeah, a little prickly. What's interesting is they're a little prickly, but they also have a quite soft beauty to them from far away.
If you don't get too close.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but the real reason I say this is that when I was on Kelia's podcast, she was I think we described her as a blue spruce, which they're in the same forest, but they're not the same tree. They're a little gentler, softer.
We're little pine trees together.
Yeah, you're pine trees. But that both of them have a great survival. They're also very like resilient, and they can stay alive in drought, and they have a great survival instinct. And I think both of them do the cool thing where if there's a forest fire, they like shoot off their pine cones and they explode and cast seeds everywhere. So no matter what happens to them, they persist.
And that's what I plan on doing if I'm ever in a forest fire. So absolutely. this has been so much fun. We will plug all your stuff and tell people where to find you in a minute. But first, Joseph, what segment are we going into now?
We are doing our blesses and curses segment of the week, where we take a work of art, media, or resource and recommend it, i.e. bless it, or diss it, i.e. curse it. Yes, we do our own version of diss tracks here. So we always let our guest go first or last, whichever, wherever she would like to go. Would you like to start us off, or would you like to finish us off, Joy?
I'm easy. You decide for me.
Okay, we will. Let's have you go first.
Are you ready?
I do. It's not the one that I know that there's something I really want to curse, and it's like on the tip of my brain. I can't think of what it is, but I do have a like a curse with less vehement hatred that I will.
Okay, it'll work. Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to save you best for last. I'll run through mine to Joseph, then we'll have yours now that we know you're ready. I'm going to bless. This is a really fun one to think about because, you know, as you think about art and literature and stuff, it's full of metaphors. So there was, you know, a lot of times I'm like, what do I bless? What do I curse? When we're talking about metaphors through an art that we can bless, there's just endless options. But first, I'm going to do the really good Christian kid thing to do. I'm going to bless the Psalms. As I've been reading through, I read a lot through the Old Testament, and I've been doing the Book of Common Prayer more often, and they always have a Psalms portion. It's interesting how often, Joy, that the psalmists and David agree with your metaphoric uses. I mean, all the way through river, light, growing. So I would say if you're looking for good places to see these metaphors in action, head over to the Psalms, I think. And aside from that, I think the Psalms are probably one of the most beautifully, one of the most beautiful pieces of poetic literature in history. So just read the Psalms, even if you're not a super, you know, Jesus freak like we are, head over to the Psalms. They will just aesthetically are beautiful, and you should absolutely expose yourself to them. I'm also going to, I realized I had another bless. I was going to bless Inside Out, which I will do, but I've blessed it before, so I'm not going to go on too far about that one. It's a great one about metaphors and emotions and stuff, so it's really good. But the one I'm really excited about blessing is a game. And I know that like only three listeners out there are video gamers, but I'm telling you, this is one of the most engaging, engrossing, and best pieces of art I've ever engaged with. And that's across all genres. So the game is called Alan Wake 2. And I don't want to give too much away, but essentially, I mean, at the end of this game, I was like, essentially moved to tears, and like, I've never seen a piece of art quite like this. It is so brilliant and ingenious and out of the box and experimental, but still grounded. It's essentially about a guy who, and you the game takes place in two worlds, reality, and then something called, I think it's called like the shadow world. It's more mental, and it's a metaphor for his mind. And what ends up happening is things escape from the shadow realm into the real world. And so, and what we, towards the end of the game, I don't want to give anything away, so if you don't want spoilers, head away. But what they end up finding is that the shadows and the things that are affecting him and attacking people in real life are actually his fears, his trauma, his anxieties, all the things that he has not fought in his mind have come out and are now affecting his outside world. So you are literally, if you want to talk about metaphor, you are literally walking around with a flashlight as your quote gun, and you are walking around this beautiful, the graphics, the music, the acting, this beautifully rendered world, and you are fighting your own shadows. Jung would be very, very proud of this game. It's just absolutely brilliant. The storytelling, the acting, the art, and just how ingenious it really is and how they brought those concepts in a piece of art. So it's absolutely amazing. Alan Wake 2. Okay, sorry, enough of the video games. I know you guys are only like three of you play them. That's all right. I'm going to curse something that'll probably make a few people angry, and that's okay. I can be wrong.
We don't need to keep listeners. What are you talking about?
Hey, listen, if you think I'm wrong, I'm really open to hearing this. Please write in a letter. Tell me why I'm wrong. I would love to actually understand this stuff. So I have been trying to add more poetry into my reading throughout the year. And I've really enjoyed some of it and really disliked a lot of it. I think I could just be dumb and don't always understand it. And maybe that's what's going on here.
He doesn't actually believe he's dumb, guys.
It's a ruse.
That's a feigned. So I've been reading, get the title right, a book called A Thousand Mornings by Mary Oliver. This book won a Pulitzer Prize. This book has been suggested to me often, and by people I actually think are interesting and deep and smart. And I'm really trying to understand, one, why it won a Pulitzer Prize, and what it is about this person's words that connects so deeply to so many people. Because from my perspective, there are pretty words, but that's about as deep as it goes. And if you kind of scratch under those pretty words, there's not much there. And so the way I kind of described it, I talked to people about it, is it feels like a book of Instagram captions, of inspirational Instagram captions that are nice. They're pretty, but not worth the Pulitzer and the depth that people tell me it has. So maybe I'm missing something, but it's a gentle curse because I'm leaving that open for me to be wrong. but I am. That's my curse today. Let me know if I'm wrong, guys. Write in, please. I'm ready. Joseph,
cool. All right. Well, I look forward to the flurry of stands to coming and say explaining why you're wrong. I haven't read it, so I don't know. But yes, sorry. Blesses. I'm going to bless a movie. Bless Big Fish, which I have blessed before on the show, but it's probably one of my favorite Tim Burton films. It's about a son and father connecting with each other through the stories and the metaphors that the father is telling. And the father really has trouble communicating except through metaphor about their life and the meaning is like. I just think it's one of the most beautiful depictions of how metaphor, the beauty of metaphor to describe experiences that are difficult to describe. So it's always a favorite. Again, it's one of the more family-friendly, wholesome, overtly wholesome Tim Burton movies. So if you're looking for one like that, then that's definitely one to go for. Curses. I'm going to curse, this is my controversial one. We'll see if people feel about it. I'm going to curse The Giving Tree. I always hated it, even as a child. So this is my way of getting revenge. But no, the whole thing is about, you know, a tree that just gives over itself. First its apple, then its wood, then, you know, and then a stump as a seat to this child that doesn't give anything back. And it's supposed to be this really sweet thing, but it's like, I don't know if it is a metaphor for how to give of yourself to somebody else. It seems less Christ-like giving of yourself and more like somebody who can't really, doesn't really know how to set boundaries for self-destruction.
The tree needs boundaries.
Yes, exactly. So this is another place where things break down because, you know, trees don't typically give; they have things taken from them. And so,
yeah, joy. You think of that one?
I don't know, Joseph. Maybe they do have agency. Maybe who knows?
Maybe they do that. Yeah. How do you know, Joseph? Oh, good retort. You heard it here, guys. Good TV. There's a fight.
Yeah, that's great. That's real good. That's real good. That's a good retort, isn't it? It's like Avatar when they thank the animals that are running from them for the giving of their meat.
Thank you for giving me your meat after I shot you.
Yeah. Then I'm going to be cursing a movie director I really love, Denis Villeneuve. Love him. Love Prisoners. My favorite movie of his. I like, you know, a lot of his movies. Arrival. Definitely. Blade Runner 2049. Yes. Excellent. I even do definitely like Dune too. But then I am going to curse his movie Enemy, which is about a guy who sees an actor who looks exactly like him. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal, and then he starts getting obsessed with his life, and then it ends, spoilers, ends with a spider. And it's just, it's one of those movies that, it's the kind of movie, the art house meaningful movie that I really don't like, that is just like, the metaphors are so in your face, but also impenetrable, that you have to have the director explaining it afterwards. But that's how all of the film bros say, but that's what makes it profound. It's like, no, it's not useful as a metaphor. It's just you trying to look smart. So I definitely, he's made a lot of great movies. That one is definitely one that I have to curse. So metaphors have to be useful in order for them to be good. Yes. Useful in community. So that is where I'm cursing there. So yeah, there you go. Cool.
It's profound because the film guy has to explain it to you. You know,
that's a whole rant I have, that like a lot of the things that film bros like are actually ones that they have to explain because it gives them power. But that's a whole other thing. that's a whole other thing. I'm exposing the film critic industry for you all. But anyway, so I'm a whistleblower from the inside. Anyway. Thank you, anyway, so much, Joy, for joining us. This was so much fun. So
No.
He hasn't done her blessings and curses.
Oh, duh. Wow, yes. Your blessings and curses. Sorry, guys.
Joseph's like, I did it.
Yeah. So first, yes. So yes, Joy, tell us your blessings and curses. I told you film critics are obsessed with themselves. Go ahead.
Okay, so I'll start with my curse, which I was telling them there's something that I know that I was passionately disliking / cursing, and I can't remember what it was now, but I'll give a slightly lower down one, which is a book called The Seal Woman's Gift, which someone was like, oh, you really like this, like, you know, it's kind of historical fiction, and I profoundly hated it. It was about this woman, apparently this is a real thing, there were all these like women who were kidnapped from Iceland and then taken as slaves to somewhere in like somewhere in the African world, I think. But the story tells her like of being kidnapped from this nice husband she has, and then she goes and she lives with the Sultan as like one of in his harem, and then like ultimately she like gives her daughter to be in his harem, and it's like she has a very luxurious life. And then she eventually gets taken back to her husband. And she's like, oh, I kind of miss the Sultan. And I'm like, woman, you're so unlikable. You literally gave your daughter to the Sultan to be in his harem. And your nice Lutheran husband is waiting at home for you. Like, what
nice
is wrong
Lutheran
with you?
Nice Lutheran husband.
anyway, so I like finished that full of rage. And I was like, this is so, it's awful. I guess she was to have Stockholm Syndrome. But it was one of those things where the book wasn't written so that you were like, oh no, she has Stockholm Syndrome. Like, they were clearly trying to like romanticize the harem situation. And I was like, not about that. Anyway.
I was talking to Kelia last night. We were looking for new books, and I'm looking for something. And I'm reading through all these book like descriptions. Do you ever read something like, you can write anything you want?
And
you chose to write that? Why? Why
I
would
know.
That be the choice? We are going to die someday. Limited time.
Yeah.
yeah. So that was my feeling. Was not a fan of the Seal Woman's Gift. Feel that she undervalued her nice Lutheran husband and overvalued the luxuries of living in a harem. So that's
not a lot of gifts going on. A lot of stealing.
Yeah. And then I have like three quick blessings. One is the book White Album by Joan Didion. I've been reading that and I think you guys would enjoy it because it's all about like the film industry and the media industry in the 60s and 70s.
Her is good. Yeah.
Yes. And she's a very compelling writer. The whole first essay is called, there's this line that everybody always quotes where she says, we tell ourselves stories to live. But it's this kind of harrowing thing because she's also questioning. It's kind of like metaphor. She's saying we do have to tell ourselves stories to live, but sometimes we can tell ourselves stories that aren't actually true. And it's really, she's just kind of compelling, amazing writer. Then I want to bless the album. Oh, what's it called? It's Seven. I can't think what the name of the album is, but it's by the Korean boy band BTS. And the reason I'm blessing it has to do with your blessing, Nathan, which is that it's all based on Jungian archetypes. So it's based on like the progression of the soul, like towards integration. And so they have this great song on the album specifically called Black Swan, which I put on my playlist that has to do with the book, which is Black Swan is like a Jungian image of like the shadow self. And they did this really cool music video. They're all great dancers. And it's all like playing with shadows and self-knowledge. And it's really cool. So I bless that. And then the final thing I'll bless is, sorry, I'm just throwing them all in there, is the painting, The Annunciation by Henry Ossewa Tanner, which I also talk about in the book. And it's a depiction of Mary as she probably actually was. So at the similar age that she would have been when she was quite young, in a room that she would have been like, because a lot of the depictions of Mary are very kind of romanticized and European. They're, you know, like Mary at the tender age of 45, you know, in a Italian villa. So this one's actually.
Those are words from Michelangelo.
I know. So this, this really. I know. So this one is, and I think Tanner is just an amazing painter. He was this really cool, like proto-impressionist African-American painter. And so I really like it a lot. It's really beautiful. And I talk about it in my book. So those are my, blessings and curses.
That's awesome. I just have to say one word about, it took me way too long when I was seeing advertisements for the band BTS, the group, that to realize it wasn't like BTS of some group. That's like, oh, that's their actual name.
Behind the scenes. What does BTS stand for? It stands for
in behind the scenes.
In the film industry, behind the scenes. Behind the scenes.
Yes.
Yeah. So someone, I didn't realize that. And when I was doing my
Is that what it stands for?
No, it actually, maybe it does. I've never thought about it, to be honest.
Now we got to go explore this, guys.
Someone once said to me when I was filming, I did like a little trailer for something for my other book, and the people who filmed it were like, well, we can give you some BTS footage. And I was like,
they want to be involved?
Yeah. I was like, of BTS and the style of BTS with BTS in the background, like how is BTS involved in this footage?
Yes, it all converges, exactly. Confusion from either end. Anyway, now we're on to the part where I tell you, thank you so much, Joy, for joining us. This has been fantastic. Very much enjoyed it. Now, if people want to buy your book or are really enjoying your content and want to engage more with, like, you know, what you have to say, where can they go? Where would you direct them?
So you can buy the book anywhere books are sold. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Baker Book House, bookshop.org, which is really cool because they give part of the proceeds to local bookstores. And then as for connecting with me, I am on Instagram and Facebook and the website formerly known as Twitter. And
I refuse to switch the name.
Yeah, it's going to be Twitter, guys.
The webpage is still Twitter, which I think is so funny. And then my kind of loci for my own podcast and newsletter is Substack. So you can just go Joy Clarkson. I think it's joyclarkson.substack.com, or you can just type in joyclarkson.com and it should come up.
Amazing. Awesome. Yeah. If you want to get in touch with us, go to overthinkers.world and join our online private Facebook group, The Overthinkers. If you want to get in touch with me, go to nathanclarkson.me, search my name, Nathan Clarkson, on any of the socials. And what should I plug today? I think I will plug I'll do my Hollywood book because it's, you know, movies, metaphors. Go pick up a copy of my Finding God in Hollywood book. It's brilliant and beautiful, like a sequoia. So go do that. Joseph?
If you want any of my nuts of wisdom,
I'm not touching that one.
You can go to my walnuts of wisdom. You can go to the josephholmstudios.com website. Also, I'm on all the socials as well. And of course, I am featured in online magazines like Religion Unplugged, Christianity Today, Relevant, Acton. You can find me on all of those places as well. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us. Thank you, Joy, for joining us. This is a real great pleasure. And remember, if it's worth thinking about, it's worth overthinking about.